authentication of the requester. One aspect is vaguely, you know, how we figure out who is making the request in sort of the offline world, and the other aspect of that is how we convey that technically, you know, whether it be certificates or some sort of password or something, whatever technical mechanism is used to convey the identity of the authenticated user. Obviously, this isn't a technical group, it's a policy group, so I think largely what we're looking for here is a somewhat high-level discussion of what we think might be reasonable requirements, and then also, as Marilyn suggested in the past, we may want to identify if either of these areas seems appropriate for further investigation by technical experts, then we could highlight the questions that we wanted to pose to them and identify the criteria and perhaps a list of candidates for bringing in outside experts to discuss these topics. But I think, as we've discussed in the past, these are topics that a lot of other questions in the decision tree stem from, so it may be a good starting point for us to try to work towards resolution on them. That seem like a reasonable approach to everyone? Great. Well, why don't we... Thomas has been kind enough to supply a little chart to us on one of these topics today. So why don't actually we use that as an initial sort of place to sort of jumpstart the conversation. Thomas, do you want to sort of talk us through what you're outlining here? I know it's just one approach using certificates to as a mechanism to identify user requesters. Is that correct?
What I've drawn up there is basically a standard public key infrastructure. On the top level, you have ICANN. ICANN looks at entities that would credit and who is data users, issues certificates to these who are data users, and maintains a list of certificates that have been revoked, so accreditation revoked. These authentication providers, which could just be about anybody, identifies the data user and gives a signed certificate to them, which says this is an accredited who is data user, and his name and address are as follows, or which maybe just says this is an accredited who is data user, and the certificate is signed with a private key that belongs to a public key, which has in turn been signed and the certificate issued by ICANN. When a who is data user wants some information from the WHOIS system, they go to the WHOIS provider, submit their request, sign the request with their private key. The public key that corresponds has once again been certified by the authentication provider. The WHOIS data provider checks that this certificate hasn't been revoked. They also check that the authentication provider's certificate hasn't been revoked. So you have the two URLs in the picture, and if nothing has been revoked and if everything verifies fine, the data is returned to the WHOIS user. So this is really just the basic scheme how you would do things with public key cryptography, which would be a standard technical way of implementing it. The basic feature here is that you avoid large databases in most of the process, because the critical information travels in certificates and can be verified. All the databases, the public databases you keep in this model, are the certificate verification lists, which are presumably much smaller than a database of authenticated users or of providers. So conceptual, on a very high level, this is conceptually the same as keeping a lot of lists around, and on a practical level, it is an approach that normally scales much better. And that's why it's often used for keeping authorizations. And I should probably add one thing. The assumption that underlies quite a bit of the terminology I use is that in this case, authentication is enough to get authorization for actually accessing WHOIS. So all you have to have for accessing the data is a certificate from one of the authentication providers, which says your identity has been verified, whatever this means. I'm not giving any specific meaning to the word verified in this moment. And then you send your query, which could include a purpose, of course, to the data provider, and they return the host data. So that's a basic idea. And if you look at the to-do list in the lower left corner, the two elements that are not straightforward about this and that really need to be filled out is what does proof of ID and verification of the ID of the who is user mean, and the second point is what kind of authentication, what kind of entities could provide authentication services in this scheme. I made some implicit suggestions, but this is, of course, very open to discuss. I hope this helps a little bit. If you have any questions, go ahead.
Yes, let me start. Before I open the floor for questions, I just want to frame your suggestion in this way, Thomas, perhaps, is that you've identified here, I guess, a particular way of implementing what really is just a system with three tiers, which is one with ICANN. I mean, and here I'm using tiers differently from who is data is available, but you've got ICANN essentially accrediting authentication providers who somehow, you know, verify the identity of a user and issue some sort of credential, and then users that use that credential in order to gain access to the Whois database. And theoretically speaking, this could be done with, you know, passwords or RSA tokens or whatever mechanism instead of certificates is actually used as the credential. But the idea is that we have a set of authentication providers and who any given user can go to and use the credential that they get from the authentication provider in order to gain access to some extra stuff in the Whois data within the various Whois databases. Would that be a fair sort of generalized way of looking at this?
So it's a very generalized way of looking at it, and
okay, great. And I think that actually matches some of, like, when we, within Task Force 2, talked about some sort of general principles we thought might be good in a tiered access model. I think that this does a good job of embodying most of those, which, you know, included the fact that there ought not to be, for example, monopoly on the authentication provision business. Let me open up the floor at this point. Do people have questions about Thomas's model in particular or this sort of approach generally? Okay, Milton, anyone else? Okay, go ahead, Milton.
I'm just wondering, what is the net change here, Thomas? I mean, in terms of what would happen differently, other than that you've got an overlay of authentication, but in terms of actually accessing the Whois data, have you just added an additional step without actually shielding any information, or is there some difference in the privacy characteristics of this system as opposed to the current system?
The difference is that you record that for access to privacy-relevant information, you would at the very least, associate the identity of the Whois user with a query. And, of course, the system also enables what I would hope for, that the Whois data provider informs the data subject of the access. I left that part out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
This was intended to clarify how an authentication model works. In this picture, I don't make a statement on things like register prompt notification, which I would still favor.
Yeah, and let me just clarify. I think that the scope of the conversation that we want to have today, I think, Milton, includes, you know, how we identify a data requester. And there's a whole other set of questions about, well, okay, so once we've identified him and he makes the request, what happens? You know, what access does he get, data does he get access to? Do we notify people? Does he get carte blanche access to all information just because he's identified? That's a whole other important set of questions. But I think if we try to initially answer a smaller set of questions about, like, how do we identify people, then once we've established that as the first step, then we can go on to the next questions and say, okay, well, we're fairly certain that we have a way to, you know, uniquely identify a user, and given that, now we have the capability to say, you know, user X gets access to this, and we do a notification or don't do a notification or whatever. But by, I think, attacking some of the more discrete questions instead of trying to engineer a whole system all at once, we may be a little bit more successful than we've been in the past.
Okay. Can you explain more what you mean by the certificate revocation list? I mean, this assumes, again, something off of the map that constitutes some kind of abuses of the data.
Well, it is something you can use as an enforcement instrument. The basic idea with public key certificates is that you get a token to the user, and this token by itself is then used in the process of verifying whether the user is authorized to do something. Now, what do you do when it turns out that user is abusing something? The token is flying around everywhere like a leaked secret key. You revoke the accreditation of an authentication provider, whatever. It's an enabling thing that makes it possible in the first place to revoke privileges. In a public key system, you can't revoke privileges effectively without something like a certificate revocation list. That is why it's in there. Mm-hmm. But of course, yes, this would be the tool to use for revoking the privileges of people who abuse them.
I have a question.
Yeah, I just have one more question if we're taking turns here. This dotted square with the word operates next to it, this means that, I'm sorry, what is the significance of that dotted square next to
the dotted line? Squares are unidentified placeholders for arbitrary objects in the same class. I didn't want to use an identifier there.
So it's just dot,
any whois provider on the left, in the left box, or any authentication provider in the right box.
Okay, all right. Could be anybody. Thanks.
Any of the objects in that class.
Great.
Okay, thanks, Mel. So was that Nicholas before that had a question?
It was Paul Stahura.
Oh, Paul Stahura. I didn't know you joined the call. Okay, Paul, anyone else at this point with questions? Okay, go ahead, Paul.
Curious on, it would be ICANN's role to certify and accredit the whois authentication providers. Is that correct?
That would be the suggestion, but of course you can outsource anything.
And then the whois authentication providers could give certificates to anybody without ICANN's approval?
Yes. The point would be that the authentication providers are the people who identify whois users, and then give out access credentials to them without ICANN intervening in any individual case.
Right, so there's no criteria. What criteria would they use to say this guy could access the whois and this guy can't? There's nothing like that, is that correct?
The easiest approach to that is the criteria is you identify yourself. We have a way to track you down. You pay a nominal fee. The idea here is to get people a little more accountable, at least.
Right, but I guess theoretically, Paul points to a separate question, which is, you know, potentially a valid one, which is, do we want to? Another thing that we could identify about people would be, you know, there's a list of things that authentication providers could actually, authenticate. One could be, you know, what's this person's actual name and address. Another thing that they could theoretically identify or authenticate would be, you know, is this person, intellectual property attorney? Is this person a sworn law enforcement officer. You know, these are all additional things that, that could theoretically be authenticated if, for some reason, we the policy was that those additional characteristics mattered. And I think we're not yet at the point that we know, you know what types of.
I hear you, but the thing is that in this model, determining that would be, you know, the who is authentication providers, not ICANN or some central authority. They're basically ICANN is delegating that decision making to whoever is an authentication provider. A and B, they would have to do that in order for us to have any kind of tiered access model, right? They would have to be. In order to have a tiered access model, there has to be some people who could get to tier A and some people who can't.
One approach to that is to say tier B is the privileged tier is in the first place anybody who identifies themselves. That's really the very simplistic model of tiered access.
And it doesn't as long as they identify themselves, they can get that information. That's the definition of the tiered access in your mind.
Well,
That's one approach I'm saying.
I see, okay. But another approach might be that those people have to be intellectual property attorneys and somehow the who is authentication providers make sure that they are or validate that they are.
Well, I'd object to that approach for some reasons, but that would be another approach, yes.
And I have a question, too.
Yeah, okay, do you have more questions, Paul? Or
I'm getting a better understanding of it.
Okay, go ahead, Marilyn.
Well, I think I just wanted to verify that I was understanding what Thomas was proposing. So that basically, when you say they would be validating that I am who I say I am, right? Not just that Marilyn Cade contacted them, but there would be some mechanism to validate that I am Marilyn Cade.
That would be the thing we would be, I think everybody would be hoping for with that model,
right.
But that's precisely the tough point we have to attack. That's what I said, what I meant when I said to do.
Right.
Requirements for proof of ID. There should be some mechanism there. Right now, I don't think anyone knows precisely what that could be, but that's a point we have to think about, all of us.
Can I just ask a follow-up? What form of identification, and I understand this is very preliminary, but what form of identification we might then spend time thinking about what's suitable for individuals versus what's suitable for business entities, like it might be suitable for a individual to use some kind of a personal government-issued ID card or something of that nature, while for a corporation it might be some other form of validation. So that would be, you know, further work to do. Then the second question, I guess, would be beyond the simplistic approach of validating that I am who I say I am.
Hello?
Marilyn?
Yeah, sorry.
Okay.
Then there would be the question of exploring whether the task force would say that there are certain categories of people who get higher tiers of access. But that's really two kinds of questions.
Right, but in order to determine the second one, the who is authentication providers would have to gather that information and verify it too. Like at first,
yes, right.
Say, okay, yeah, you're Marilyn Cade because you have a U.S. passport, and we verified all that. But we don't. You have to prove that you're whatever, an intellectual property attorney or a member of Interpol or something.
Well, no, Paul, that would only be that would be a second. I was suggesting that's a second step of. If the task force decided that they were going to propose that some categories of or some classes, I'm trying to make a neutral statement about this, some categories of requesters need to be put into different buckets. So I'm a business person and I want to check to see who I'm doing business with, or I'm law enforcement, or I'm an IP attorney, or I'm a government employee, or I could be a wide range of categories. But I think that is a different work initiative than just authenticating that the person is a real person, that they have legitimate identification.
I agree with that.
Let me put it like this. You have two questions to ask, two decisions. Let me put it differently. You have to split any scheme that would be based on classes of data users into two parts. First, associating some data user with a class, and second, translating class membership into authorization. What you would normally do is to translate class membership into authorization on the data provider side, and to turn class membership itself into a certificate attribute. So the certificate you get from whatever authentication provider, or normally called certification authority, you use would say, this is Marilyn Cade, and by the way, she's an AT&T employee. Or she is a member of a certain attorney or whatever. Normally combine that, just speaking technically here. Anything else becomes ugly.
Well, I just, it's not just a technical issue. I mean, yeah, you're describing a technical process for basing a certificate upon classes of people, but I hope we don't even consider going down that road. The only class of people that would have any special rights to access information would be law enforcement, and that is something that would be not easy to certificate on a global basis, but possible to. But when you start talking about these other kind of finer categories, I hope these are being used for example purposes, and nobody seriously wants to go down that road, because it's just not a viable thing. And besides, you know, being an intellectual property attorney doesn't give you any more rights to view private information than being a operator of a pizza parlor. I mean, that's just a fact in the law.
Yeah, I think that...
Just for the record, I agree with that point of Milton.
Sure, and I think, you know, once again, we're not trying to answer the question today of, you know, who gets access to what, just how we would go about identifying people. So I think that we have identified that there's two questions really here, or really more than two, but at the very least, you know, one question is how we identify five people or organizations. And then the secondary question is, beyond simple identification, do we want to otherwise classify these individuals? And if so, how do we do so is another set of questions.
Right. You would only need, you'd only need one class. Other class. Basically, you'd have three classes: a guy who doesn't have a certificate, a guy who has a certificate but doesn't belong to whatever class we define, and a guy who has a certificate and does belong to the class we define.
Well, maybe you don't really have to have that. It would be in the last class, only local law enforcement could be in, I would say. So you don't even need that certificate, because you already do have certain lawful mechanisms to get that information. So I would even kind of restrict it to two players.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we can actually sort of play out that conversation. I think it's probably important to think about, you know, if we wanted to have one or more additional classes. I don't want to presuppose anything either way, but I think you're probably right, Paul. We don't want to get into a scheme where we have, you know, 1,000 different variations on this, depending on what type of individual or organizations making the request. But just to sort of think about this more generally, you know, beyond identifying people, are there additional things we want to find out about the person or organization making the request that would somehow be relevant to making the who is query? And maybe the answer to that will be yes, maybe it will be no, but at the very least, we have to think about how we might convey that information if it is important.
Can you repeat what you said? I didn't quite understand it. I'm sorry.
So I guess I'm saying...
Oh, Tom. The one who...
Oh, Tom.
Yeah.
I think Tom was... let me paraphrase what Tom was saying, I think, which is that we might not need that other class because law enforcement already has a way, you know, they can subpoena you or whatever to get the information.
Oh, I understand. Okay. Well, then that's even better. It simplifies the heck out of it. Then I agree with Thomas Osler's diagram. It makes sense to me. Basically, you have two classes, the guy who has a certificate and the guy who doesn't. That's it. And if you get a subpoena, that means that's like a third class that's outside this, you know, kind of outside of this system.
Yeah. And it may be that law enforcement, I guess, would there be some special subpoena certificate that would speed up their access?
Well, it would probably be called a telefax.
Yeah, we know. Law enforcement hasn't quite gotten...
I mean, theoretically, Milton, that it would be possible to have a special type of certificate that conveyed that something, you know, something extra.
But it would have to be issued by... you're right, it would be... have to be integrated into the court system process, which it almost certainly isn't yet, so...
Yeah, I mean, presumably to do that, you would actually... To alter Thomas's diagram a little bit, you might have actually two classes of authentication providers, because presumably the people that are just, you know, checking out whether or not you have a, you know, a passport or a driver's license that has the same name that you're claiming on it is a whole different sort of type of authentication than whether or not this guy is a, you know, is a law enforcement agent. Presumably the people that have competence in one of those categories don't necessarily have them in the other one.
Yeah. One of the key issues here, which I think Paul started to raise, which we haven't really discussed, is whether ICANN really has the capacity to monitor the behavior of these people that it certifies to be WAPs. And, you know, are there any issues there that we might want to discuss?
There would be a financial incentive for those people to, since there's, I would presume they're selling these certificates,
yeah,
to just not do that great of a checking, just to make more money and do higher volumes.
Definitely.
There has to be a little bit of oversight on them to make sure that they, you know, when they say this person is, you know, Joe Smith, he really is Joe Smith, and then if they're wrong on that, that they get their certificate revoked from ICANN.
Yeah, and I think there's actually two interesting data points on this from the real certificate world, or the sort of e-commerce certificate world, which is that on the one hand, there has recently been, to support what you're saying, Paul, I think sort of a rush to the bottom in terms of what is actually done to issue like an SSL certificate. If you look back 5 years ago, you know, VeriSign would, and the very few other players in the space at the time would, you know, do a pretty thorough vetting of anyone applying for a certificate. You know, they would look up information in your Dun & Bradstreet file. They would call, you know, some contact there. They might do additional checking as well to make sure that they're issuing the certificate to the right people. Whereas now, you'll see some certificate issuers just will send an email to whatever address is in the whois. So if you happen to be able to, you know, hack into that account, or if you have briefly been able to alter the whois or something, there's pretty good ways to get an SSL certificate that, you know, because the level of diligence maybe isn't quite as high. On the flip side of that, there have been very, very few cases of certificates being incorrectly issued. The ones that VeriSign issued to Microsoft are the only ones that I'm aware of where it's been proven that a certificate has been wrongly issued by a certificate authority. So it may be that you can easily over-engineer something, so even though you know, there's a theoretical attack that could be made on the system, it works 99.999% of the time. So, you know, is it good enough?
Those people who are getting those certificates normally have a domain name, and so, you know, and the people who are selling the certificate are now more and more the registrar, and so the registrar knows that whoever's coming to their system is the actual owner of the domain name. It's pretty straightforward nowadays. But this, I don't believe that these users, the Whois users, actually are a domain name owner, right? So it's a little bit more difficult, I think.
No, I agree. I mean, it's definitely not the same problem set. I'm just expressing that even though there has been this sort of like definite declining, level of verification over the years, it hasn't had an obvious effect in terms of a lot of proven instances of invalid certificates being issued to the wrong parties.
Well, I want to raise a pretty fundamental point about this, Thomas, in terms of the the overall structure here. I now understand is basically simply a technical diagram of how you might do what was called a whitelist in our earlier discussions. And as you recall, there was not consensus on a whitelist. There was an alternative concept of an individual use capability in which it wasn't so much the status of the Whois user as an approved user that you wanted to reveal the information. It was more the nature of the specific request. In other words, yes, you'd want to authenticate who they are, but the key issue was that didn't give you a right to just go fishing in the Whois records. You had to have a particular purpose related to a particular domain name in order to go fishing, or in order to get to the second tier of information. You wouldn't go fishing at all under that. How might this structure be modified to embody that concept?
Well, I guess part of this may be due to the fact that we are coming into this from different task forces. As far as Task Force 2 is concerned, I think there was a lot of discussion that the purpose would be given along with the request, mm-hmm. and would be information given by the requester themselves and recorded by the data user. So if you look at the diagram, you would add comma request behind certificate on the lowest arrow.
Yeah, I guess.
Comma purpose, I'm sorry.
Right, and Milton,
so
I think...
The purpose would travel along with the request, with the query, and would also, of course, be signed. So this is really a thing between the user and the Whois provider, and hopefully the registrar, and they learn about themselves.
Right, and what I was going to add is that once again, this may relate to just what the different task forces thought about, but two of the concepts that we had looked at and I think gotten fairly sort of rough consensus around in terms of thinking it was the right direction, if not necessarily the right solution, was that the concept was that you, even though you might have to provide the purpose for each individual request, we wanted to still allow legitimate requesters to not have to go through a really laborious authentication process every time that they wanted to make a request, if for some reason they had to do so on a somewhat regular basis, assuming that all the requests are legitimate. And in those cases, a certificate really just acts as a way of proving who you are.
I know that.
Yeah. In a quick manner, right? So it just gives you a portable way of avoiding a laborious authentication process on a repeated basis.
But that's not the point. What I want to avoid is a situation where you have unlimited rights to fish in the Whois data, regardless of whether you have a particular purpose, which is contrary to the privacy principles of the EU and many other, and basically common sense. It's not that we're not tearing the information in order to just add a layer for the sake of adding a layer. We're tearing it in order to make sure that people are not just mining the data for the sake of mining the data. They have to have a specific legitimate request. So I'm just concerned about how the structure might reflect that or not.
Yeah, and I think, the scope of our initial conversation here is, how do we identify people? The follow-up question is, okay, now we've identified you, so what? What do you get out of that? And I think the issues you're raising are very valid and things that we'll have to grapple with once we move on to that phase.
I have a quick question.
Yeah. Paul, did I hear Tom before trying to get in queue? Or am I going crazy?
No, I was trying to get in queue, but never mind.
Okay.
You more or less answered all what I was going to say.
Okay, great. Thanks. So go ahead, Paul.
I'm unsure on whether the Whois user is actually a domain name holder. I think that they should be a domain name holder and have their own Whois in the Whois system. Is that correct, Thomas?
I wasn't saying that. And actually, I put in AT&T as one of the examples for a purpose because think about the corporation. If you build a system in which an entire corporation, a large group with lots of people who will ultimately access the system, gets a single access credential, then you lose accountability. Shared credentials are a good way to have public credentials, ultimately. So the idea would be that large, for instance, domain name holders or data users or groups or professional associations could actually serve as authentication providers for their employees to the extent to which these people have to access the system. So I think in many respects it would scale or could scale badly to have data users as domain to identify data users as domain name holders, as much as I would probably prefer not to have a need to have a system scale on the data user side.
That's interesting, but if there was a large company, let's say AT&T, that got a certificate and they had a bunch of users using it, if there was abuse from any of those users, all of AT&T would get turned off, I would assume. So there's a large incentive for AT&T then to police their own people. So there's an opposite force from what you're just saying, I think. Does that make sense?
Well, you have a point there that the incentive is there, but I would believe, I think from a practical point of view, you want to break it down by the individual data user.
So who is a provider then? How do I know? What's the mechanism to find out who is user is? Without, you know, if they had a domain name in the certificate, I could just look up the Whois for that domain name that came with the certificate.
So why don't you include the information who they are with the certificate? There's attribute for that.
Yeah, certificates contain the ability to convey all of that information, Paul. So you could have name, address.
Yeah, I hear it, but it's, you know, we already have domain names in the Whois system to find out who people are.
Yes, but the point is, you wouldn't use Whois to identify the data users. So Whois authentication providers would collect who are you and what your set of contact data that ICANN has mandated must be collected. And that information goes into the certificate. So it travels together.
I understand that, but it just seems simpler if they just provided a domain name. And then those Whois users have to follow all the rules of having accurate Whois information for that domain name and so on. And the only information that would have to travel with the certificate would be the domain name. But I see your side, too. It's a practical question, I guess.
Yeah, it seems to me, Paul, like, to a certain extent, because we're so familiar with sort of domain names and thinking of domain-centric solutions, that we're sort of creating a...
we don't want to overload what...
Well, we're creating a linkage that doesn't necessarily exist. There's nothing about, you know, making a Whois request that necessarily implies that you have a domain name already.
Right.
And it seems somewhat artificial to impose that requirement.
Wouldn't there be some kind of a closed circle where only people who already do have a domain name being able to look up a domain name?
Essentially that does. And then you were raised for sort of the chicken or the egg problem of, you know, if you want to start looking at information and someone wants to verify information about you, how do they get it because they don't have a domain name yet? And
will there be some central access to find out who everybody who's able to look up Whois information? Right now, as a Whois provider, I'll only be able to tell who comes to me, you know, on a like daily basis or whatever, and I could store that in my own database, who all the Whois lookup guys are. Would there be some way of getting that from a central location, like from the CRL? In other words, if the identifying information of who the Whois guy lookup guy is, it comes with the certificate and it's not in the Whois, I'll only be able to get that by getting a bunch of certificates. Is there a centralized place for that?
Wait a moment. If you send a request in the model proposed here, you have a set of data. You have the domain name or whatever other object is being asked. You have maybe the purpose. And you have quite a bit of the information in the certificate that's hashed together and signed. And then you attach the certificate to the query. So the Whois user sends that information to the Whois provider, and they would keep it available, pass it on, whatever the policy says they are supposed to do with it.
Correct. So that would mean that the Whois provider would be able to get the like name and address of the Whois user from the certificate, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I won't be able to know who all of the Whois users are, only the ones that came to, for example, Enum to get Whois. Is there some way to find out who all the Whois users are?
Well, why would you want to do that?
It might have, there could be a variety of reasons. I'm just wondering if it's possible, or should I just save up every time somebody looks at the Enum Whois, just save up who they are, and that would give me a good sample of all of them.
Well,
I think I want to avoid getting sort of too far off track here, but I think, Paul, that it would in a traditional PKI model, the answer to your question is probably not. Depending on what sort of credential we actually issued, like it could be that we'll decide that we want to use like a centralized username and password database, in which case there probably would be some sort of list somewhere maintained by someone. But it would depend to a certain extent on what sort of credential was actually being issued and whether it was valued as part of the process, whether that was one of the policy requirements imposed was that we wanted to have some central list of all the Whois requesters. So let me actually, we've been talking about this for a while, and it seems like the general framework at least may be heading in the right direction. So in thinking a little bit, there's still a lot of unanswered questions. So perhaps in thinking about how we might move this forward and where we might look for some maybe external advice for, it seems that we've got a couple of major questions here. The first is how we actually identify people. And sort of the sub-questions of that are what information should we gather? You know, do we care about their name? Do we care about their address, their phone number? You know, which of those bits of contact information or characteristics we think are important. And then the follow-up question to that is how do we verify that information and make sure that it's genuine instead of just typed in? And a follow-up question, so that's one sort of set of questions. The next set of questions is what sort of credentials that we would actually issue, whether it be a certificate, a username and password, or something else. And the follow-up question to that would be which is most useful, which is supported by various systems that might be used in the Whois system, and particularly thinking about Iris or technologies like that. Obviously, we don't want to say, oh, well, let's issue credential X, only to find that the technical systems out there aren't going to support it. And then the final question that we sort of have talked around is who do we allow to obtain a credential? And maybe that's everyone that applies and meets, and can identify themselves, or maybe it's someone different. But the third question, I think we probably, it seems like a pure policy issue that we don't necessarily need a lot of outside help with. But the first two sort of topic areas, how we go about identifying people, and particularly how we check to make sure that the information is authentic. And then in the second topic, what sort of credentials might actually be useful within the context of the Whois sort of technology framework. It seems like places where it might be useful to go to whatever outside expert resources we may be able to track down. What do people think about that? Am I missing, is this misguided, or are there things?
I think another one is contractual stuff. for example, a guy who gets a certificate is able to get the upper tier information, I assume. Is he then okay to give that to anybody he wants?
Maybe. That actually falls into a conversation we'll have later, which is so once you've been identified and have a certificate, what can you do with it? And we're intentionally
not just what can you do with it, but where do you sign the contract to say if there's any limits on what you can do with it, you sign this contract that says you obey those limits.
Right. So I guess part of the credentialing process is that you have to, there's some terms of service that you have to agree to. Presumably there is going to be some sort of terms of service. And we just need, at some point, we'll need to figure out what goes into that.
Right, because if they can transfer it, then to a spammer, they just make thousands of queries and download the WHOIS database, and then they sell it to give it to somebody that does not have a certificate, and therefore it's not traceable. And you're right where you started.
Well, don't forget that, first of all, you know the person who is using it or who is responsible for the certificate. And the other thing is that some certificates can be revoked in case of...
But you don't know that person gave the data away. How would you know that?
You can see, if someone is making a thousand and a thousand requests, that he's not doing it for a purpose we kind of identify, which is good up front, so you can't kick him out of the system. But that's something we still have to define. I agree on that.
There's another method. You could also, when the guy asks for certain names, you give him certain information when that guy asks. When another guy asks, you give him different information. And then you could track, if you ever see the first information out there in the public, you know which guy got it. I don't know if that made sense. In other words, they ask for myname.com. Certificate A asks for that. I give him this address A, Certificate B asks for it. I give them address B in the WHOIS output. It's like a honeypot name.
Yeah.
So that's after you've sort of identified a problem?
Yeah, my question is, what's the penalty? Like, say some guy does sign this contract or click through the terms and conditions thing, and then you, lo and behold, gives it out anyway to a spammer. What's the penalty on that guy? We know who he is, but now what? We know who he is, and we know that he gave it out. All the information. Then what?
Right. Well, I think that does point to an important issue within, these questions that we're talking about today, which is, when we talk about what sort of credential we do issue, sounds like at the very least we need to make sure that we have some ability to revoke the credential if there is, misuse of it. So that's an important characteristic that we could use to drive that discussion.
I agree, but the cat's out of the bag. And then the guy comes back with, and gets a different certificate. Doesn't
right.
He?
Well, we can put them on the blacklist, but I would assume that there is no perfect system where you can avoid all misuses. There will always be some ways to trick the system and to game it, and the only thing we can look forward to is to build a system which is as stable as possible and not trying to spend years and years and years to create a system that's perfect.
Well, accountability mechanisms that don't work that don't lead to any consequences aren't worth much. See also safe harbor. But I think in this case, the obvious point would be if any WHOIS data user is caught abusing the data, they lose their credentials. They may not be in a position to regain them for a certain time. That would be an obvious punishment, unquote, within the system. You could also, of course, get further and make information accessible to law enforcement automatically or whatever. There is, after all, in some countries, laws against spamming. The point here is, once people abuse the system, you take the credentials away, and then you look what kinds of remedies are there for the kind of abuse we have observed.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not sure what else beyond that we could do, within this framework at least. There's no.
I think you're right.
We can't send a homing missile through the telephone line to take them out. So, I think we'll have the good thing about a system in which we have identified the user in advance, is that at least we sort of know who and where they are if some sort of offline remedying is necessary. Okay, so to get back to my questions, do we think that these are topics that, you know, the question of how we go about identifying people, and in particular how we make sure that the information is authentic, as well as what sort of technical credentials are useful within the WHOIS context, are those topics that we think are useful for, or where we want to bring in maybe some outside experts, or at least solicit outside experts to try to get them to provide us with some advice?
Well, I think the fundamental process of certification, I guess, is not really a technical issue, I think, that we're dealing with here. We're dealing more with questions of what is in the certificate, who, you know, can we trust ICANN to certify and accredit these and properly supervise these authentication providers? Have any of you identified a specifically technical issue?
I don't think necessarily, Milton, I don't want to say that it's necessarily a technical issue per se, but I think that when you talk about how you verify that information like this is authentic, there's different approaches that could be used and different information that we could say are easy to authenticate,
yeah,
and some,
yeah,
which are hard.
Right.
For example,
okay,
you know, telephone number is pretty easy to sort of verify that the person making the request is at that telephone number, right? Because you can just call it and see if they answer and if they're the ones that actually made the request. Whereas, like, I don't know, actual name, mailing address, you know, similarly easy, just takes a lot longer because you have to send something to the mail. Name's pretty hard. You either have to get them to show you some ID, which means that they have to, like, come to you or something like that, or there's got to be some other mechanism to validate the name. And I think going to going to exist, you know, incumbent certificate providers or someone that's sort of in the,
yeah, like industry
business,
people, I think that's what we need to talk to.
Yeah, exactly. Might be useful to figure out which of these attributes are easy to identify and what approaches might be reasonable to have ICANN propose to these authentication providers. So, yeah, I think you're right that it's not necessarily technical experts. It's in this case, it would be industry, some sort of industry expert. And then on the second thing of what type of technical credentials, I think there we are talking more about the people involved with maybe the IRIS project.
Well, I personally think it would be a good idea to get the VeriSign people on board on that. And having one person maybe from the certificate part and maybe the other guy who's developing CRISP or IRIS, however you want to call it, you know, I mean, that they make a presentation of what these technologies are about and how we could use it for our purposes.
Right, and I think we've already had sort of generalized introductions to CRISP and IRIS before. Now we want to, I think it's still valuable to continue to have that dialogue because it's an evolving protocol. But, you know, we may just want to specifically ask them what sorts of authentication credentials might be usable within IRIS and what the pros and cons of various ones might apply. And then, you know, it could, on the certificate side, it could be VeriSign. We could also reach out to other, you know, players in the industry, although VeriSign really has a strong presence in that space, obviously.
Yeah, sure, but I mean, there are a couple we know, and I'm sure that we could get more as one expert on that, you know, because I guess that certain different certificate companies apply certain different mechanisms to authenticate people, you know. For example,
right.
I know that the company we use is doing it differently as VeriSign, and I know that GoDaddy, for example, is doing differently as VeriSign again. So there might be a variety, and it's all worth listening to.
Yeah, I agree with that. So the question is how we if we agree that these are sort of general places where we want some expert feedback, how we go about, you know, finding the right ones to talk to, and part of that is, you know, maybe create, you know, defining the characteristics of the expert, and then part of it's the selection process as well. And we can do this pretty informally, I think, is, you know, we can, if people want to maybe nominate a few people in each of the categories, we could probably just agree to two or three in each group, maybe, or maybe just one or two in the case of the Chris Virus stuff. I think that, you know, we don't have government contracting rules here. We don't have to be supremely we don't have to have an incredibly, you know, burdensome process to select people. But, you know, if people have suggestions, it's probably useful, that, and we can talk about them on list. Marilyn, are you on the call still? Okay, maybe not. I know she had some ideas in the past about reaching out to various people. So so with regard to this, you know, to getting industry experts on the actual authentication process, Tom, I think you're right. VeriSign's probably good people to reach out to. Does anyone else have suggestions of places we might want to, or people we might want to talk to on this topic?
Yeah, I think we should involve GoDaddy, Tim Rose, or whoever is responsible within GoDaddy for certificates.
Okay. I know that in the past, at least on the other side of the WHOIS equation with regards to identifying registrants, hasn't Rick Weston said that he's, you know, talked about capabilities to identify?
That's true, people. And to check the WHOIS information,
yeah,
some kind of technology, I think.
So that might apply this other way as well, as identifying requesters as well, presumably.
I would be careful about word that case. The technology presented by Rick was about plausibility checking address data. That's something different from identifying people.
Right.
Not picking it here, but it's really a different kind of service.
I think the hardest thing is going to be figuring out what the WHOIS user needs. For example, if they need a phone number, in order to give us a phone number, they need an address, or they need, you know, to be a member of some group or whatever. What
right.
do they need to give?
And that's actually an important, that's separate from the sort of verification process, that's actually an important policy question for us to answer, I think.
Right.
Which is,
exactly.
Yeah, which is, you know, what are the list of things that they need to provide?
They need a domain name or not, you know, whatever.
Prove they're authentic.
Do they need to be an individual, or do they need to be a company? Maybe either.
Well, that's an important policy issue, definitely.
Right.
Are we, I'm going to have to get off pretty soon. I wonder, we're not discussing the step-by-step procedure for national law exception?
No, I think that is going to be next week.
Okay. So is there any major thing we haven't discussed with respect to this tiered access?
No. So with respect to this, what we'll take away offline, I think, is I'm going to put together maybe an initial list of things that we might want to, a list of things we might want to verify. So we've identified some of them already, individual versus company. Do they have to hold a domain name? And then, you know, other fields we might want to verify, name, address, phone number. And I think we ought to define that list before we go out and solicit industry expertise, because it's going to have different answers depending on what we want to verify. But once we do that, which hopefully we can do fairly rapidly on the list, I think we ought to maybe put together a list of experts we might want to go and solicit some feedback from on that topic. On the other side, technical side, I think we probably ought to, another briefing on maybe CRISP and IRIS is probably in order, and maybe something we could set up in the context of Cape Town, since some of those people may be planning on being there. I'll try to find out, and then we could talk, we could maybe pose them specific questions of what sort of credentials might be useful within IRIS to identify people.
Yep.
So next week I think we're back to our Tuesday call, and we'll talk about the step-by-step.
Should we plan, you know, I guess some of us are going to go to the Cape Town meeting. Should we plan on connecting up at some point during that week?
Yeah, I think, Glenn, are you on the call?
Yes, I'm on the phone, Jordan.
Am I correct in thinking that somewhere in the schedule at Cape Town there's slots for, like, task forces or something like that, right?
Yes. The slot for the task forces is on Wednesday, the 1st of December.
Right. So most likely, Paul, on Wednesday, we'll have some time to meet as a group.
Paul, will you be there?
Yes, but I believe isn't the registrar's meeting Monday, December 1st and 2nd, all day long?
Yeah, that is in fact so. So there's a conflict there.
I'll just skip out, I guess, for a while or whatever. The registrar.
Because obviously, that's not going to the WHOIS meetings are not going to go on the whole day because there are the two task forces, number one and number two. There is also the registry approval process, which is a council group working on it. So perhaps you could just slip out of the registrar's meeting.
Right. So we'll just have a couple of hours at some point, probably.
Because you'll be in the same boat, Jordan.
Yes, that's correct.
At what time would that be, the task force meeting?
Well, that hasn't been completely worked out yet, but Wednesday has been kept apart for the special room for task forces.
Thanks.
And there will be on Friday a public forum before the council meeting. I think it starts at 8:30 to about 10:30, where matters that have come up in the task forces can then be put out for public discussion.
Right. So the other thing we'll want to do prior to Cape Town is perhaps identify issues that we want to flag within the public forum, but we can do that in the weeks to come.
It would also be useful if you could let me have whatever documents you would like printed so that you have got something to work on there. A little bit before time.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Great. Any other thoughts or comments before we wrap this up?
Sorry, great. Jordan, one more thing. Steve Metellus wasn't on the call this afternoon, was he?
He was not.
That was Nicholas, yes.
Yeah, that's correct. Okay, thanks, everyone. I think we're making some good progress here, and we'll have a few issues to hopefully finalize before we move on to more interesting topics, I think, within this tiered access topic. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Jordan.
Thank you, Jordan.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
Bye.